Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening, everybody. My name is David Wright. I am a librarian with the Seattle Public Library's Reader Services Department, and I'd like to welcome you all to tonight's event with Richard Ford. I'd like to thank the Elliott Bay Book Company and Mr. Ford's publisher, HarperCollins, for partnering with us in tonight's presentation. Also want to thank the Seattle Times for their generous promotional support of library programs. Thanks to our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis. And finally, thanks to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker. I'll keep this short. In my work as a librarian, I get to talk with all sorts of readers who read for a lot of different reasons, different tastes, and many different kinds of readers. And there's a certain kind of reader that we will see every so often who expects a great deal from literature, but for whom reading has a real cost. Books are very important to them, but maybe they read 10 a year, 5 a year. And often this reader, when I'll ask them who they enjoy, they will quickly drag me to the deep end of the pool and mention writers usually labeled as classics. Faulkner, Fitzgerald, Flannery O'Connor, Virginia Woolf, perhaps Walker Percy or Graham Greene. And then they'll say, but I'd like to read somebody contemporary. Can you suggest somebody who would be worth my while? It's kind of intimidating. At these moments, there are few names that leap so readily to my mind than Richard Ford's. Ford has been writing the kinds of novels and stories that invite comparison to those kinds of writers for decades, stories that tackle and engage readers with the biggest kinds of issues, who we are, why we're here, where we are, while staying sharply focused on real and really interesting people. It is a great pleasure of mine to get to share with readers the three books featuring Frank Bascom, beginning with The Sports Writer, which I always think of as kind of the gateway drug for... and the Pulitzer and Penn Faulkner Prize winning Independence Day and The Lay of the Land. Ford's short stories are also staggeringly good. I've just had a chance to get started on Canada, but I'm very much looking forward to sharing it with our readers as well, just as I am very pleased to present to you our speaker for tonight, Richard Ford.
Thank you, David, very much. Thank you so much for coming. It's really an honor for me to get to come here, and Seattle being one of my favorite places to come in the world. I used to come here a lot in the 80s when Ray Carver was alive. It was sort of a gift to me from Missoula to get to drive the 500 miles over here to get to come. It feels wonderful to be here. And I want to also thank you for supporting this magnificent library and also for supporting the precious Elliott Bay Books, which I know is the mucilage that really holds a community like this together. When my friend John Marshall, who wrote a wonderful book about the library and its history, took me here a few years ago, it was just simply an amazing experience for me to be in this building. I was a child of the library in Jackson, Mississippi. It was a far cry from a cool house experience. It was cool there. My mother only took me there because she could safely drop me off and go back home and just be alone for a while. And the library, in fact, in Jackson, Mississippi, was the only air-conditioned place in town other than the movie theater where you could do that. And I want to say this also about Elliott Bay. I've been a devotee and a visitor to Elliott Bay for 25 years, which is, in my estimation, a long time. But it has given me, and as it has given everybody like me who writes the sorts of books that I write and who appreciates literature in the way that I particularly do, a life. We wouldn't have a life in this country if it weren't for Elliott Bay, if it weren't for independent booksellers all over the country. So know, and I know you do know, how wonderfully fortunate you are. I'm going to read you the beginning of this book, because if I read you the beginning, then I don't have to do all of the blah, 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 blah about, you know, who this person is and what happened before the passage that I read to you. And so you're already going to sleep. So I'll just read you the beginning. And moreover, it's the case, I think, that if you can't make the beginning of your book good and make sense, you really don't have a chance. Novelists should always read the beginnings of their books. First, I'll tell about the robbery our parents committed, then about the murders, which happened later. The robbery is the more important part, since it served to set my and my sister's lives on the courses they eventually followed. Nothing would make complete sense without that being told first. Our parents were the least likely two people in the world to rob a bank. They weren't strange people, not obviously criminals. No one would have thought they were destined to end up the way they did. They were just regular, although, of course, that kind of thinking became null and void the moment they did rob a bank. My father, Bev Parsons, was a country boy, born in Marengo County, Alabama, in 1923, and came out of high school in 1939, burning to be in the Army Air Corps, the branch that became the Air Force. He went in at Demopolis, trained at Randolph near San Antonio, longed to be a fighter pilot, but lacked the aptitude and learned bombardiering instead. He flew the B-25s, the light medium Mitchells that were seeing duty in the Philippines and later over Osaka, where they rained destruction on the earth, both on the enemy and undeserving people alike. He was a tall, winning, smiling, handsome six-footer. He barely fitted into his bombardier's compartment with a big, square, expectant face and knobby cheekbones and sensuous lips and long, attractive feminine eyelashes. He had white, shiny teeth and short black hair he was proud of, as he was of his name, Bev, Captain Bev Parsons. He never conceded that Beverly was a woman's name in most people's minds. It grew from Anglo-Saxon roots, he said. It's a common name in England. Vivian, Gwen, and Shirley are men's names there. No one confuses them with women. He was a nonstop talker, was open-minded for a Southerner, had graceful, obliging manners that should have taken him far in the Air Force, but didn't. His quick hazel eyes would search around any room he was in, finding someone to pay attention to him, my sister and me, ordinarily. He told corny jokes in a Southern theatrical style, could do card tricks and magic tricks, could detach his thumb and replace it, make a handkerchief disappear and come back. He could play boogie-woogie piano and sometimes would talk Dixie to us, and sometimes like Amos and Andy. He had lost some of his hearing by flying the Mitchells, and was sensitive about it. But he looked sharp in his honest GI haircut and blue captain's tunic, and generally conveyed a warmth that was genuine and made my twin sister and me love him. It was also probably the reason my mother had been attracted to him, though they couldn't have been more unsuited and different, and unluckily gotten pregnant from their one hasty encounter after meeting at a party honoring returned airmen near where he was retraining to learn supply officer duties in Fort Lewis in March 1945, when no one needed him to drop bombs anymore. They were married immediately when they found out. Her parents, who lived in Tacoma and were Jewish immigrants from Poland, didn't approve. They were educated mathematics teachers and semi-professional musicians and popular concertizers in Poznan who'd escaped after 1918 and come to Washington State through Canada and became, of all things, school custodians. Being Jews meant little to them by then, or to our mother, just an old, exacting, constricted conception of life they were happy to put behind them in a land where there apparently were no Jews. But for their only daughter to marry a smiling, talkative only son, Scotch-Irish, Alabama backwoods timber estimator, was never in their thinking, and they soon put it out of their thinking altogether. And while from a distance it may seem that our parents were merely not made for one another, it was more true that when our mother married our father, it betokened a loss, and her life changed forever, and not in a good way, as she surely must have believed. My mother, Neva Camper, short for Geneva, was a tiny, intense, bespectacled woman with unruly brown hair, downy vestiges of which ran down her jawline. She had thick eyebrows and a shiny, thin-skinned forehead under which her veins were visible, and a pale indoor complexion that made her appear fragile, which she wasn't. My father jokingly said that people where he was from in Alabama called her hair Jew hair or immigrant hair, but he liked it and loved her. She never seemed to pay these words much attention. She had small, delicate hands whose nails she kept manicured and shined and was vain about and gestured with absently. She owned a skeptical frame of mind, was an intent listener when we talked to her, and had a wit that could turn biting. She wore frameless glasses, read French poetry, often used terms like cauchemar or trou de cul, which my sister and I didn't understand. She wrote poems in brown ink bought through the mail and kept a journal we weren't permitted to read, and normally had a slightly nose-elevated, astigmatized expression of perplexity, which became true of her and may always have been true. Before she married my father and quickly had my sister and me, she'd graduated at 18 from Whitman College in Walla Walla, had worked in a bookstore, featured herself possibly as a bohemian and a poet, and had hoped someday to land a job as a studious small college instructor married to someone different from who she did marry, conceivably a college professor, which would have given her the life she believed she was intended for. She was only 34 in 1960, the year these events occurred, but she already had serious lines beside her nose, which was small and pinkish at its tip, and her large, penetrating gray-green eyes had dusky lids that made her seem foreign and slightly sad and dissatisfied, which she was. She possessed a pretty thin neck and a sudden, unexpected smile that showed off her small teeth and girlish, heart-shaped mouth, though it was a smile she rarely practiced, except on my sister and me. We realized she was an unusual-looking person, dressed, as she typically was, in olive-color slacks and baggy-sleeved cotton blouses and hemp and cotton shoes she must have sent away to the West Coast for, since you couldn't buy such things in Great Falls. And she only seemed more unusual, standing reluctantly beside our tall, handsome, outgoing father, though it was rarely the case that we went out as a family or ate in restaurants, so that we hardly noticed how they appeared in the world among strangers. To us, life in our house seemed normal. My sister and I could easily see why my mother would have been attracted to Bev Parsons, big, plank-shouldered, talkative, funny, forever wanting to please anybody who came in range, but it was never completely obvious why he would take an interest in her, tiny, barely 5 feet, inward and shy, alienated, artistic, pretty only when she smiled, and witty only when she felt comfortable. He must have somehow just appreciated all that, sensed she had a subtler mind than his, but that he could please her, which made him happy. It was to his good credit that he looked beyond their physical differences to the heart of things human, which I admired, even if it wasn't in our mother to notice. Still, the odd union of their mismatched physical attributes always plays in my mind as part of the reason they ended up badly. They were no doubt simply wrong for each other, and should never have married or done any of it, should have gone their separate ways after their first passionate encounter, no matter its outcome. The longer they stayed on, and the better they knew each other, the better she, at least, could see their mistake, and the more misguided their lives became, like a long proof in mathematics, in which the first calculation is wrong, following which all other calculations move you further away from how things were when they made sense. A sociologist of those times, the beginning of the 60s, might say our parents were in the vanguard of an historical moment, were among the first who transgressed society's boundaries, embraced rebellion, believed in credos requiring ratification through self-destruction, but they weren't. They weren't reckless people in the vanguard of anything. They were, as I said, regular people, tricked by circumstance and bad instincts, along with bad luck, to venture outside the boundaries they knew to be right, and then found themselves unable to go back. Though I'll say this about my father. When he returned from the theater of war and from being the agent of whistling death out of the skies, it was 1945, the year my sister and I were born, in Michigan at the Wurtsmith Base in Oscoda. He may have been in the grip of some great unspecified gravity, as many GIs were. He spent the rest of his life wrestling with that gravity, puzzling to stay positive and afloat, making bad decisions that truly seemed good for a moment, but ultimately misunderstanding the world he'd returned home to and having that misunderstanding become his life. Again, it must have been that way for millions of boys, although he would never have known it about himself or admitted it was true. Our family came to a stop in Great Falls, Montana in 1956, the way many military families came to where they came to following the war. We'd lived on air bases in Mississippi and California and Texas. Our mother had her degree and did substitute teaching in all those places. My father hadn't been deployed to Korea, but been assigned to desk jobs at home in the supply and requisition forces. He'd been allowed to stay in because he'd won combat ribbons, but hadn't advanced beyond captain. And at a certain point, which happened when we were in Great Falls and he was 37, he decided the Air Force was no longer offering him much of a future, and having put in 20 years, he ought to take his pension and muster out. He felt our mother's lack of social interests and her unwillingness to invite anyone from the base to our house for dinner may have held him back, and possibly he was right. In truth, I think if there'd been someone she admired, she might have liked it, but she never thought there would be. "It's just cows and wheat out here," she said. "No real organized society." In any case, I think our father was tired of the Air Force and liked Great Falls as a place where he thought he could get ahead, even without a social life. He said he hoped to join the Masons. It was by then, the spring of 1960, my sister Berner and I were 15. We were enrolled in the Lewis for Meriwether Lewis Junior High, which was near enough to the Missouri River that from the tall school windows I could see the shining river surface and the ducks and birds congregated there, and could glimpse the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Depot, where passenger trains no longer stopped, and up to the municipal airport on Gore Hill, where there were two flights a day, and down the river to the smelter stack and the oil refinery above the falls the city took its name from. I could even, on clear days, see the hazy, snowy peaks of the Eastern Front, 60 miles away, running south toward Idaho and north up to Canada. My sister and I had no idea about the West, except what we saw on TV, or even, for that matter, about America itself, which we took for granted as the best place to be. Our real life was the family, and we were part of its loose baggage. And because of our mother's growing alienation, her reclusiveness, her feeling of superiority, and her desire that Berner and I not assimilate into the market town mentality, which she believes stifled life in Great Falls, we didn't have a life like most children, which might have involved friends to visit, a paper route, scouts, dances. If we fit in, our mother felt, it would only increase the chance we'd end up right where we were. It was also true that if your father was at the base, no matter where you lived, you always had few friends and rarely met your neighbors. We did everything at the base. Visited the doctor, the dentist, got haircuts, shopped for groceries. People knew that. They knew you wouldn't be where you were for long, so why bother taking the trouble to know you? The base carried a stigma, as if things that went on there were what proper people didn't need to know about or be associated with. Plus, with my mother being Jewish and having an immigrant look and being in some ways bohemian, it was something we all talked about, as if protecting America from its enemies wasn't decent. Still, at least in the beginning, I liked Great Falls. It was called the Electric City because the falls produced power. It seemed rough-edged and upright and remote, yet still was part of the limitless country we'd already lived in. I didn't much like it that the streets only had numbers for names, which was confusing, and my mother said meant it was a town laid out by pinch-penny bankers. And of course, the winters were frozen and tireless, and the wind hurtled down out of the north like a freight train. And the loss of light would have made anybody demoralized, even the most optimistic of souls. In truth, though, Berner and I never thought of ourselves as being from anywhere in particular. Each time our family moved to a new place, any of the far-flung locales, and settled ourselves into a rented house, and my father put on his pressed blue uniform and drove off to work at some base, and my mother commenced a new teaching position, Berner and I would try to think that this was where we'd say we were from if anyone asked. We practiced saying the words to each other on our way to whatever our new school was each time. Hello, we're from Biloxi, Mississippi. Hello, I'm from Oscoda. It's way up in Michigan. Hello, I live in Victorville. I tried to learn the basic things the other boys knew and to talk the way they talked, pick up the slang expressions, walk around as though I felt confident there and couldn't be surprised. Berner did the same. Then we'd move away to some other place, and Berner and I would try to get situated all over again. This kind of growing up, I know, can leave you either cast out and adrift, or else it can encourage you to be malleable and dedicated to adjusting, the thing my mother disapproved of, since she didn't do it, and held out for herself some notion of a different future, more like the one she'd imagined before she met our father. We, my sister and I, were small players in a drama she saw to be relentlessly unfolding. As a result, what I began to care greatly about was school, which was the continual thread in life besides my parents and my sister. I never wanted school to be over. I'd spend as much time inside school as I could, poring over books we were given, being around the teachers, breathing in the school odors, which were the same everywhere and like no other. Knowing things became important to me, no matter what they were. Our mother knew things and appreciated them. I wanted to be like her in that way, since I could keep the things I knew, and they would characterize me as being well-rounded and promising characteristics that were important to me. No matter if I didn't belong in any of those places, I did belong in their schools. I was good at English and history and science and math, subjects my mother was also good at. Each time we picked up and moved, the only fact of life that made moving frightening was that for some reason I wouldn't be allowed to return to school, or I would miss crucial knowledge that could assure my future and was obtainable nowhere else, or that we'd go to some new place where there would be no school for me at all. Guam was once discussed. I feared I'd end up knowing nothing, have nothing to rely on that could distinguish me. I'm sure it was all an inheritance from my mother's feelings of an unrewarded life, though it may also have been that our parents, a swirl in the thickening confusion of their own young lives, not being made for each other, probably not physically desiring each other as they briefly had, becoming gradually only satellites of each other, and coming eventually to resent one another without completely realizing it, didn't offer my sister and me enough to hold on to, which is what parents are supposed to do. However, blaming your parents for your life's difficulties finally leads nowhere. Thank you. If anybody has a question, I would be honored to. Yes, ma'am.
I grew up in Tacoma. I'm curious about the setting part of the story in Tacoma and how anybody growing up in Tacoma could possibly feel superior.
Well, if you're Jewish immigrants from Poland who escaped after 1918 and you feel yourself rather insulated, feeling superior may be actually the only way you can get along. Actually, I set that in Tacoma because I like seeing the word Tacoma on the page. but I actually thought that probably that phenomenon is true anywhere. And I could have said it someplace else where I liked the way the word looked on the page. I'm always somewhat victimized by words that I like to see on the page. I mean, I said everything that I have said, which is now considerable, in Great Falls because I like to see Great Falls on the page. Every time I wrote it, it can either be a trochee or an iamb. It can be Great Falls, or it can be Great Falls. You can put the stress on either word, and those, because I guess partly because I'm dyslexic, the non-cognitive quality of words is always somehow integral to the reason that I choose words. How they look, how many syllables they have, how many long vowels, how many short vowels, what their syncopation is in an interior way. You know, that's because what words mean was always somewhat a tricky business for me. Getting the denotation of a word off the page and then caused to reside in my brain. So I was fastened onto words much because of how they looked and how they sounded. So choosing Tacoma, which brings with it clearly a history for you, and choosing Great Falls or choosing Saskatchewan brings with it a history, but I have to kind of think that if I put it down on the page because I like how it looks, I have to engage the history in some way. But thank you. I mean, look, I'm from Jackson, Mississippi. You ain't got nothing on me.
I heard on the NPR review yesterday that you started, it said that you started this book 25 years ago.
1989, is that 25, 24? Yes, I did. Well, I started it in this sense. The lady said that she had heard on NPR that I started this book many, many years ago, and indeed I started it in 1989, which is very unusual for me. I've never done that before. I was living in a little wheat prairie town north of Great Falls with my wife, and we had moved over there really running away from Missoula and wanting to be able to go pheasant hunting every day. But because I was waiting for the return of a manuscript of a book I had written, which was slow returning, I thought, well, I'm a writer here, so I have to write. So I rented a little room above a car repair garage. And the little town only had about 200 people in it. And I wrote 20 pages of what I called Canada, and it was about a boy who was made to go across the border into Saskatchewan because his parents had, for some reason I hadn't even worked out, been unable any longer to take care of him. Then the book came back from the publisher, and I set those notes aside, and I put them in an envelope, which I stuck in my freezer. And over the course of the next 20 plus years, I would go on making a note. I'd make a note just in my notebook. I mean, I have a little notebook here somewhere if I haven't lost it. And then I would just write it in my notebook or on the back of a napkin or on the back of a plane ticket and stuff it sort of mindlessly into this envelope, not ever really going back and sort of addressing what I had written, thinking that this is all good, this is all good. One day I'll come back to this. So when I finished the lay of the land, I thought, well, I should write a book after it. And so I hauled that stuff out of the freezer, and out of that big morass of notes, I concocted this book, right? Which, as I say, I'd never done before. I'd always just done it in the regular way of writing books, which is you get something in your brain, and then you start working on it, and you keep working on it until it's finished. But that was a little different. Question was to talk about how my contemporaries influence me, and particularly, if I can sort of truncate your question just a little bit, since I was great friends with Ray Carver, how he might have affected my life. I think I live in a time of great good fortune in American writing, because there's just a whole lot of really good writers working in America now, women and men. I try to represent this in such books as The Granted Book of the American Short Story, which I've edited 2 times, try to do something to encourage readers to read my contemporaries. You know, when you ask that question, who first came to mind was Deborah Eisenberg. And I don't even know how many of you know Deborah Eisenberg. She's chiefly a short story writer. She writes in The New Yorker. She lives in New York. She's married to Wally Shawn, the actor. But she's just really one of the most remarkable short story writers writing. I couldn't do anything like what she does. There's just no way in the world. But what I am influenced by when I read her work, and I'm just choosing her because that's who came to mind, is how smart she tries to be on the page, how much she lets in to her stories, how free she manages to be within the confinements of any sentence that she's writing. One of the things that is difficult for young writers and writers who are not young is to not, as you go through the story, not somehow feel like you're operating along a template. In other words, to close your mind as the story begins to take shape to verbal possibility, to possibility of different incident from what you might have planned. And Deb's stories are full of surprises, and they're just the kinds of lambent surprises that come into anybody's mind when you are your best self. She seems to bring her best self to every sentence that she writes, and that's difficult. I don't know if you can even try to do it. That may be what talent fundamentally is. But when I read her work, segue to Alexander Heman, similarly, although he was born in the former Yugoslavia and learned English late in life, he has the same ability to bring great ingenuity, verbal ingenuity, great intelligence, great sort of a kind of almost joy into his stories. When I read those things, I feel encouraged. And what I mostly feel is there's something I have to learn. There's something I have to do better, even at age 68. With Ray, I mean, Ray and I sort of fell in love with Ray about 1977, and we were great friends. I was writing novels, and he was writing stories. What we discovered was that his parents were from where my parents were from, which is to say Western Arkansas. And we had a kind of an affinity beneath the surface. And I think it's fair to say that he made writing stories seem so attractive that I went back to try to write stories myself, and was able to write some stories that I think are okay. And his were better, but mine were okay. We never really talked about work. Writers generally, when they are sort of sympathetic to each other, talk more about women and money and and things like that, and problems, you know, how your health is and things like that, what kind of car you're going to buy, going fishing, everything else, all the literary stuff that you might read in Vladimir Nabokov's letters, we didn't do. And in that way, I probably wasn't, as a novelist, surely, ever influenced by his work at all, other than in the way that I described Deb Eisenberg. When you are great friends with somebody who is a flat-out great writer, well, then you are encouraged to be a flat-out great writer, or else you just simply fold your tents and go away. And Ray was the kind of personality who always encouraged. He never discouraged. He was always generous. He was always somebody who, when he walked in the room, your life was better. Yes, sir.
Can you talk about your process, particularly the way that you set out to write a novel, and whether you actually plot out a novel ahead of time, or you just let it happen with a loose framework?
I'm too much of a Nazi to just let anything happen. I'm just one of those people who wants to control everything. I mean, I wanted to be in the FBI. When these things didn't work out, I became a novelist. I just decide, because of an accumulation of material that I find in my notebook that seems to interest me, that I'm going to write a novel and it's going to take 2 or 3 years. And what I do is I just go through all of my notebooks, and I've got a lot of these notebooks, say for 15 years, and I type out everything out of those notebooks onto pieces of paper. And then I, in the process of doing that, try to imagine what the arc of a book could be that all this material could then fit into. And then I get a big notebook, plastic notebook that's got rings in it, and I put dividers, just like kids would do, where the kids would say history, social science, science. Mine say the names of my characters, the place where the book occurs, where it takes place, some of the principles that I want the book to operate under, all kinds of formal features, and then I sort of just enter all these random notes into this notebook. Many times the same note will appear for different characters because I don't know who I want to have say a certain thing or think a certain thing. And then I get this big fat notebook of about 250 pages all typed, and then I annotate them, and then I just study it the way you would study for a bar exam. And then over the course of study, I began to sort of limn out how a book would start and what sorts of ways along the path it would visit, and then where it ends. And then when I realize that I'm enjoying planning too much, then I start trying to think about a first sentence and a first scene. So it's a wonderfully awful process, because it's so clerically a morass. But what it does is, and I will read this notebook sometimes 3 times a week. It assures me of knowing everything. It assures me of being immersed in the material completely. And so I never have a day when I go sit down at my desk when I don't have something to think about, because it's all in that notebook. I don't recommend this. Well, because it's tedious, and you look at things, the same things, so many times when you don't use it, and you're constantly looking through things, and then when I put something into the book, I check it off so that I don't inadvertently put it in again later. It's just, you know, it's like all things that aspire to greatness, they're tedious.
When did you begin writing?
Well, I began writing a couple of little forgettable stories in high school, put it all aside, went off to college and forgot about it. And then I was studying, I was going to be a lawyer, and I'm telling you more than you want to know, but I was in college, and I had three majors in college. I had French and history and English, and I needed something in my schedule that was easy. So I took a creative writing course from this guy who was once a quarterback on the Oregon football team named Jim Calderwood. And I wrote a couple of little stories for him, and he said, Faulkner, Faulkner, Faulkner. So I went away and went to law school. And when I was in law school, I had a course in real property that was right across the hall from where Stanley Elkin was teaching. And every time I could, I would steal across the hall and sit in Elkin's class. And about after I'd been in law school for a while, I thought, what I'm hearing here is a lot more interesting than what I'm hearing over there. So I quit law school, and I moved to New York, and I married my sweetheart, and I, in 1968, said, this is what I'm going to try to do for. I'm going to give myself enough time to fail or enough time to really give it my all. And so I started doing that in 1968, which is, what, 44 years ago. 10 books, that's not very much, but it's enough. It's enough. Yeah. Yes, sir, please. The gentleman just asked me a question about my sort of attitude toward fatherhood, and am I peculiarly interested in that because I have written a lot of books and novels which involve relationships between parents and their children. And I guess I must be interested in those things. I mean, I'm always reluctant to relate things back to my biography because it always seems to sell my imagination short when I do that. But I mean, my father died when I was 16, and so I didn't have a father after that. I had a mother who loved me. They both loved me, and I loved them. I was an only child. So that fundamental sodality of parent-child was basic to me, and because it was so unalloyed good, I think that I am drawn to it and drawn to trying to put it under duress in stories in order that it be able, through the agency of my imagination, to fundamentally survive and to be affirmed. I mean, I don't think I've written any stories about families in which the basic family unit, although it might be again distressed and it might be sundered even, is ever eroded as an institution of affirmation and survival for people, because that's what I have found. I am not a parent. My wife and I don't have any children. So in a way, I mean, there's a line of Thoreau's, I think, which Randall Jarrell quotes, in which he says, sometimes it is for the writer, that the writer is not the person who has the experience as much as he or she is the person who needs to have the experience. And I think in a way that I write about those things in a way that is either compensatory or reconciliatory about my own life, so that, I mean, I'm obviously responding to some need. And I think it's probably a need that is very like the question you asked me before about Canada. I have a series of unending emotions which do not have a satisfactory vocabulary that I have inherited. In other words, that most writers want to try to say something that they don't understand. On the basis of certain kinds of unphrased emotions that they have. And the thing that they say and the thing that becomes the book that they write is not a transference. It's not an articulation of a thing waiting to be articulated. It's simply something made up on the strength of a strong emotion. I mean, most writers, sometimes people ask me a question, did you know you had something to say? And that's a perfectly reasonable question to ask if you would at least countenance the answer being no. Because the answer is no, because all I had was a set of very strong emotions about a number of things, and being a writer gives you a chance to give a certain dominance to those emotions and let yourself respond to them. Well, you've been very kind. Thank you so much.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.